So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello, hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink, where over the last couple of episodes, we've been exploring resistance and release, that inner tug of war between the life we know and the life we sense we're ready for. Now, sometimes, as I've said, that change begins quietly with a whisper and a sense that something is no longer quite right. But other times it's more abrupt, like an ultimatum, a health scare, a rock bottom, that can make it feel like a door is being slammed shut and we're left staring at the wood grain, wondering what the hell just happened and what we're going to do about it. So let's have a think today about what if that closed door isn't an ending at all? And what if it's the start of something new and brilliant? And I'm joined in the studio, I'm delighted to say, by author and coach Eleanor Tweddle, whose brilliant book, Another Door Opens, maps the messy, hopeful, and very human process of navigating change. And together we're going to talk about what happens when we embrace that space between one chapter ending and another one beginning, and why the moments that feel most uncertain are often the ones that open up most possibility. And then of course, this being the Big Drink Rethink, we're going to think about that in the context of alcohol and invite you to see change not as a loss, but as an opening. My God, a coachy, wanky term, going to invite you to see change, not as a loss, but an opening. Welcome to the show, Eleanor. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I was just mesmerised there by what you were saying. I think I could have listened to that forever. Just keep going, Anna. I'm just going to sit and listen.
Shall I carry on? Just
I love that.
Kickbacks. Yeah. Kick back and I'll do a monologue for 40 minutes. Brilliant. So, no, thank you for your time today, and thank you for coming on and sharing both your experiences and your thoughts. So why don't we start there with you telling listeners a little bit. You do look like you just want to listen, actually.
I do. Just like, I'm in listening mode.
No, I'm going to ask you to take the mic. I want you to talk a little bit, tell listeners a little bit about your background and the experiences that have inspired you to talk and write in this space.
Well, I guess it's the old cliche, because now we're all losing our job in various ways. But yeah, I lost my job about 10 years ago and had a moment of going for interviews, applying for jobs, doing the old stuff, because that's what we do in change moments. We default to comfort zone. So I was doing that. And in an interview, someone asked the question, why do you want this job? And everything inside of me wanted to kind of go, I don't actually, I don't even know what I'm here for. I didn't say that. I had a better answer, but I felt that really harshly. And so on the way home, it just sat with me and I thought, okay, this is maybe a moment where I have to listen to that and not ignore it and do something about it. Because I think we all have those sort of moments of little like, maybe something should change. But it's very easy to ignore it and just keep going on anyway. But I didn't. I sat with it and I decided, okay, what if I hang about with people who run their own business, not people who are looking for more corporate jobs? What if I go and sign up to something very random? I signed up to the Do Lecture Bootcamp, which was crazy thing to do. It was full of really creative, cool entrepreneurs. And I felt like I sort of was a walking PowerPoint. So, you know, it was one of those moments. So that's where it all started for me. And I just started getting really interested in why is it so hard to change? I realized that all my corporate career had been about change, communicating change. And yet I was really bad at it. So that's where it started.
Yeah, cool. And it probably isn't the right thing to say, but thank God you did lose your job because you wouldn't be doing what you're doing today. And I suppose that's, you know, that is the big sort of full circle story of this, isn't it? That it opens up huge opportunities and stuff. But yeah, it's something that we've been talking about because you do have, you do get this resistance. And sometimes when, you know, talking to drinkers, there's this sort of quiet voice that's sort of saying, you need to sort of knock this on the head. You need to sort of change. And then there's this horrible sort of voice of resistance going, ooh, that sounds scary. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. It's a sort of risk aversion type thing. And I guess that's why we do find change hard. But, you know, your book and a lot of what you talk about in your coaching starts with the idea that a closed door can actually be the start of something really exciting and something new. Why do you think we find it really hard to believe that in the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question to sit with. And I think there's many kind of personal things going on for people that we can't ignore. We can't pretend that, you know, it's all just one idea and you've got it sorted. But I think the notion of tomorrow is really appealing. So if you think about the amount of things that probably are on your to-do list right now that you'll do tomorrow, that just gives us a little insight into just how we do life. Like, tomorrow I'll do this, tomorrow I'll do that. And change, whether it's big or small, is no different. So I think there's something there about us. It's not that we're resisting and holding back and thinking, I mean, sometimes we are, but it's not that we're like, no, it's not that. I think it's just the notion. And we absolutely believe ourselves when we say, I'll do it tomorrow. So for me, I kind of hear that a lot, which is an interesting one when you think about us having to eventually, tomorrow comes and we eventually have to make a move.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think if you're sort of thinking to yourself and it's a purely sort of, you know, solo monologue, you're having this conversation with yourself about needing to do something about your drinking, then there's always going to be a sense of, oh, I'll start after Christmas, or I'll start on Monday. I'll start on Monday is a classic one. And, you know, I just get the weekend out of the way, which is a sort of, yeah, kicking it down the road. But then I suppose that's when you're doing it out of almost sort of a sense of choice, maybe reluctant choice. Sometimes these things are sort of forced upon us, a redundancy, you know, a divorce conversation you didn't see coming, or an ultimatum. As far as drinking is concerned, change this or this marriage is over, you know, that sort of thing. And then I guess we can just really feel like we're up against the ropes and we go into kind of a defense mode as well. And we feel very, very bruised. And then we want to push back and go, I will do this in my own time. You need to feel ready.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's still the notion of tomorrow. So even when a door closes and it hasn't been in your gift, there still is the notion of tomorrow, but it's the notion of I'll make it good tomorrow, or I'll sort this out tomorrow, or I'll. So that's where we kind of become survivors, or we just get through the next day without properly taking control. And that's what I really saw in my first book, was just completely about redundancy. Mm-hmm. But the second book was what is wider. It's about wider change. Because I started having wider conversations with people on that very subject. And there was patterns. So like you came on the podcast, Anna, on Another Door podcast, and you shared your story. And it was so interesting around the same patterns come up. You know, there's a moment something shifts, whether mm-hmm. it's you or whether it's something else. You sit with it for a while and then you decide to own it. That's actually the most important moment. When you go, I'm going to own this and it's going to get messy, but I'm owning it. So I think it's that little shift that the new book is trying to kind of help people through.
Yeah. And well, in you know, I can't imagine the situation. I'm trying to think really hard of a situation where ownership and accountability and, you know, and feeling motivated to do it for your right good reasons, feeling very, very emotional about it as well, and being compelled forward by a sort of a positive image and a sort of positive emotions doesn't work. I mean, I can't think of a situation where it, where there's an exception to that, really. I mean, in your book, you introduce your 5-step framework for navigating, and you're really keen to point out it's any form of change, you know, any stage in life, any type of change. Have you ever come across a situation when confronted by change that this process doesn't apply or doesn't work? I mean, I guess you might move through the different phases at different speed, might linger longer in one or the other, but do you utterly sort of believe in its universality, as it were?
Yes. And the more I talk to people from all sorts of different scenarios, the more it started to make sense, even micro changes in our life. I was running a workshop yesterday for a corporate leadership group, and we were talking about micro changes. Things like somebody cuts you up, you're driving to work and someone cuts you up. Exactly. That just feel that, you know, what happens there. But you have to remind yourself that we all have choice on how we're going to react to that. It's a change. It's a micro change, because you're just driving along, listening to whatever, you know, cool radio station or podcast, and somebody has now interrupted that flow. So it's a change state, and you own that state. But that so many of us don't recognize that, and we just allow the anger, like, oh my God, beeping the horn, what have you done that for? And all we've done is change our state. So by the time we get back to the office, we're angry. We've now leaked that all over our team. We bring it to the meeting. We fog our decision making because we're still cross about this thing. We've completely changed the state of the whole day. Whereas if you think about just taking that moment and the 5 steps, activate it really quickly. So you can activate these steps quickly. Stop, breathe. Just get a little bit messy with, okay, I'm uncomfortable with this, but let's play with how I could respond. I can just actually think, well, maybe they're having a bad day.
Yeah, put the middle finger away and give them a wave.
Maybe they, exactly, smart. Maybe they got lost. Yeah. Maybe they're just having an awful time. And then let's just try and kind of, yeah, exactly, just be kind and then restart your day and get to the office in a really lovely space. So, yeah, I actually believe that the kind of steps, you're right, they're not linear. You don't go through them. At some points you need to go back and remember, I've got to stop, breathe, step out, try again. And as you uncover more things, you get more messier and messier probably. But it just helps you to frame that I've got choice. And once we know we've got choice in change, it suddenly becomes a little bit of a different story.
Well, it takes the victimhood out of everything, doesn't it? And you know, I know you came up across your first sort of closed door, as it were, slamming shut with redundancy. And for other people, it's, God, it can be the death of somebody. It could be, you know, something that you just, something completely unforeseen that you just feel can be completely unjust, very, very cruel. But it's a reminder that we can always navigate these things on our terms. We can turn it around, and it is ownership, and it is, as you say, it's a choice. And it's hard, but it's very empowering when you think, whatever happens in the world around me, to me, I can respond on my terms. And I can actually, and I know this is a real stretch for people often, I can play with it. I can take it very heavily, or I can choose to sort of bear it a bit more lightly. But again, it's all choice. So let's talk about the process, because it is cool. And it reminds me, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning another author who in the space where I read, you know, years ago, it was a guy called Henry Cloud, Dr. Henry Cloud, I think, to give him his correct title. And he, you know, he talked about, he's written a book about necessary endings. And he, you know, he really emphasizes that clearly change is inevitable. You know, if we can sort of put a little bit of a process like this in our back pocket for whenever it happens, You know, it's about being prepared for it. And actually, sometimes you can intercept and you can make sure that things close down on your terms and open up in a very sort of controlled or empowered way. But the change itself is inevitable. So it's a good thing to you know, listen to this conversation and bear in mind what those steps are. So I obviously want to sort of talk to you about them as they might specifically relate to alcohol. But let's talk about them in broad terms first. The pause, that's your first step. Something happens, the door slams shut, the pause. What happens in this space for you? What happens in the sort of stillness rather than running around like a headless chicken going, oh my God?
Which is an option.
Which is an option.
That's fine.
Get that out of the way.
We can do that. It's yeah. fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just to pick up that point about the change is inevitable, because that's kind of, it links into the pause bit. Change is actually with us all the time. And that's the weird thing when you think about it. So we're actually changing every single day we get up, we've got older. So we've already changed. We're really good at change as humans. And so the kind of myth that, oh, we're really bad and we resist, it's actually not true, because we change every single day and we're adapting. And we're flexing, and some things we pick up, some things we don't. And that's the point. So the point of pause is stop and think is about acknowledgement. So it's the moment you acknowledge change. So it could be a birthday that you hit 50 and you go, and I'm obviously talking for experience here, you look in the mirror and go, oh my God, how did this happen? I've been getting older every single year, day. Minute, but yet this birthday has just suddenly made me go, what just happened? It's the acknowledgement. So you're sort of standing there, go, oh my goodness. And the acknowledgement is the pause where you go, what does this mean to me? Do I need it to mean anything? Maybe not. I could just let go, keep moving on. It doesn't matter. Or is it, or I'm going to grab it and make it a bit more intentional. So the pause bit is this exploration of, we can acknowledge all sorts of different change around us, but what are we going to bring into our thinking that is meaningful for us? So pause is about understanding what it looks like for you. Because part of my research, I realized some of us are brilliant at pausing in terms of like go and lie in a field and meditate and incredible, like go and sit in a room, silence. But I realized that's not me. I'm terrible at that. So I think I'm bad at it. But what I'm really good at is the sort of doing pause, which I can distract myself, take myself out of the overthinking, maybe understand rest in a different way, create space for maybe some different kind of thought-provoking activity that gives me a different energy. So step one is about acknowledging and then creating some space that you need to then explore it through a different lens. So it's really sitting with the question, like, what do I need right now?
I mean, there's so many different things that I want to pick up on. I love the fact that you built on the inevitability of change to say it's happening every minute. Because it's true, isn't it? We're not the same people we were last week. We're not the same people as we certainly were 5, 10 years ago, even if we might try and act like it sometimes. But we're not. And you know, I'm often confronted, you know, with clients, lovely clients who say, I can't change. So, yes, you can. I can't change. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. So
do you just do that for an hour?
Yeah, that's exactly, that's kind of how my coaching goes. Just go backwards and forwards like this, and then I just go, oh, shut up.
You know what, I kind of feel like I might need that, Anna. I might book in just that, because sometimes that's exactly what we need in these moments.
I'm just giving my secrets away. That's the entirety of my coaching. It is pointing out that sense, though, that we are hardwired to change. You know, evolution
it's true,
is part of the human species timeline. You know, we change all the time. We are brilliant at adapting. Our brains adapt all the time, and we can make them adapt as long as we give ourselves permission to do so. And part of that permission is to almost stop the fight and to then say, okay, what do I need? If it's not going to be this fight over resistance, if that's not going to be my weapon, what do I need right now? And sometimes it might be a holiday, you know, or it might be something entirely different. I would sort of stress it. It's hardly ever alcohol, because what you're doing in that space is, if you're going to sort of respond to crushing news, with, oh my God, I need a drink, which is very, very common, clearly, what you're not doing in that moment is listening. You're going, I'm terrified, I'm scared, I'm worried, I'm anxious, I'm cross, I'm resentful, I'm, you know, I'm furious and all sorts. But you're not really listening to those emotions. You're just saying, I don't want to feel them. So you're actually using alcohol in that space is the opposite to letting those thoughts come and really thinking, what do I need?
I think that's an interesting one in the pause, because you're right. What is, when you search for alcohol, is it a pause in your own way, but you're not taking it to the next thought, which is, what do I really need right now?
Mm.
So that's the point. If we don't stop, we are going to do something. We always act. So we default to something and we think, all right, alcohol, just take this away, or it'll just help me kind of like get through the next day, or just make me feel better. But if we really sit with the question, what am I need right now? It's like, oh, I just need some space to think, or just to believe that this might be all right.
Mm.
You might get a different answer on what you do next. So it's such a great example of the sort of default of reaching out for what we know just to comfort us in the short
reflex.
Term.
It's a reflex, isn't
yeah,
it?
That's it. Reflex. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
And when I work with people around alcohol, or even when people do kind of my online programs and stuff like that, that there's a real space for pause. I tend to sort of frame it slightly differently because of this tug of war that's been going on in people's mind. And often it's about, you know, a voice saying, you need to cut back, moderate, for goodness sake, what's wrong with you? And the other one's going, nah, it's all right, you know. And then you just kind of go, look, just stop. And, you know, stop with the, almost stop trying to stop. Stop trying to sort of fight and start trying to learn, which is very, very, very aligned to what you've just been saying in terms of letting that intuition and letting that voice come in about what you really need. Because it's in that learning that you can kind of create a sense of safety and trust. You know, okay, it's all shitty at the moment and I get it, but I can cope with this. You know, and in from an alcohol perspective, from that pause place, we're sort of saying, start getting really mindful about, you know, why you drink. So instead of fighting, just pause, understand why you drink, do a bit of work around that. What emotions are you drinking at? What triggers are you drinking at? And just try and identify things a little bit more. But you know, really notice.
Because I think to take your point there, Anna, it's really important for people not to just take it literally. Like, a pause is not stop drinking. You know, you can't, as you say, like, that might not be an option. So it's and any change is actually the same. It's very rare you can go from, you know, there to there, really leap. The leap is really hard. So we're not, yeah, exactly. We're not saying the pause is stop drinking. It's stop just being on default. And start helping yourself. Because, yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Just it is. It's exactly that. It's this idea that, I'm trying to think of the right words, but it's where you sort of start turning resistance, for which I'm also saying lots of negative feelings, into more reflection.
That's it.
And then when you, because then when you're reflecting, you're opening up the space for possibility. Because you're beginning to just calm, or you're also, I mean, physiologically what's going on as well is you're just calming down that nervous system, which has gone into complete fight and flight because of, you know, the sort of the stress that the news or, you know, the moment might have created, or your concerns about the future are creating, and you're just saying, just calm it, you know? And then you just become open to more possibilities. Okay, cool. So what comes after the pause in your system?
Well, this is why sometimes we don't want to pause, because what happens is, and that was exactly as you described, we get messy and we have to just know that that's what happened next. And it's often why we don't do change well, because we don't acknowledge it. And then we don't open up, like you just described, to knowing that the next phase is really uncomfortable. You're going to have to face things that you don't want to face. There's no easy way through this, really. So getting messy is opening up to understanding that. And suddenly that becomes a little bit easier because you're not thinking I'm doing this wrong. You get an acknowledgement, oh, I'm doing it right because I'm facing things that maybe I haven't really been facing before. I've been pushing them away and that's what's been actually getting in the way. So you find out new things about you. You find out maybe things that you haven't really wanted to talk about or think about.
Yeah.
But
I was going to ask that. Yeah. What kind of things can that messy bit, you know, actually teach us about ourselves?
Yeah, and it's so personal. And this is where sometimes having support around you in the messy bit is really useful.
Mm-hmm.
And again, being really specific with what support you want, because there's so much out there, but finding someone who can help you through the mess, who can reassure you, depending on what it is. Some people need counseling in this moment because they discover, oh, it's all about my childhood, or it's rooted in something that I just have never addressed. And you just cannot move forward without addressing some of these things. Other times it's like, well, no, I just didn't really realize that life has been changing and I haven't acknowledged it. So, you know, if you're female, it could be menopause that you're just not acknowledging and it's having other effects on you and you just haven't brought it into your thinking. So you get some bit more specific help if you can kind of get a bit messy, but we're still in the messy phase. So it's just being open to that rather than diagnosing. Because I see a lot of people just jump straight into, oh, I think it's that. And then they invest a lot of money in trying to get help and it was never that.
But that's because we want a quick solution, isn't it? Again, we'll grasp the first thing that we think might help us through because we want out. I think that's the thing. It is the antithesis of being happy to stay and feel it. I know that from my own personal experience, you know, that sort of real messy stage for me was so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable because it was all wrapped up in, you know, and this goes the same actually for drinking, or if you've lost a job that you've sewn or knitted your identity to for years, is that whole identity change. Who am I? Can't reinvent myself. I'm too old. So up come all the limiting beliefs. It's just the way I am. You know, I'm being surpassed by all the young ones out there, you know, all that sort of, you know, the workplace career redundancy type chat, you know, AI is going to be doing my job anyway, who's going to want me, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's like limiting belief after limiting belief after limiting belief, which if you don't see them for what they are, you can drink or, you know, again, throw yourself into other sort of distracting and sort of self-destructing, but ultimately numbing behaviors. But it's, you know, it is uncomfortable and it's messy. And this is the stage, I suppose, where you have to have that courage. You have to have the courage to say, no, I've got to work this out. And it's not going to happen overnight.
And know that it's all okay. I think that was one of the aims of the book, was to make it all right to have all of that uncomfortableness. Because I don't know how you felt, Anna, but because we think that we have to have perfection, whatever that is, anything that feels uncomfortable feels wrong. And we push against it. So you're right to highlight that bit, because I think we try and avoid it. Whereas the whole book is, no, just wade right through it. There's so much goodness in getting messy that actually it's a good thing. You'll find so much out about you, about your friends, about family, that will get you to a better place eventually. You just got to be prepared to go through it.
And I think something that we talked about in a conversation pre-podcast was, you know, something that you raised that I really, really liked, which is this notion of, you know, almost trusting the process, or at least trusting the universe, that, you know, you used the phrase, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is so powerful. You know, and I remember there being some kind of something flashed up on Instagram or something once, one of these kind of inspirational quotes, you know, which is, even after the longest night, there will be a morning, you know, there will be daybreak. Yeah, it was a bit cheesy, but the point is, it's true. It's true, yeah. Isn't it? It's just a moment in time. It might feel like an eternity, but it is going to pass.
It's almost changing the notion of tomorrow You know, we started the podcast with the sometimes tomorrow is the reason why we're not changing because we're putting things off.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the notion of tomorrow can actually, if we have a different relationship with that and say, tomorrow will bring great change, tomorrow will bring me better change, then suddenly that shifts us to a different kind of mindset to work through it. So,
get messy. But in certain things, and it actually just, you know, one of the most obvious things to say is when it comes to, you know, say someone's trying to quit alcohol, that messy bit really is very tangible because you're going to be going through things like cravings and all the sort of the reasons why you were drinking before are going to try and pull you back. And it's about going, no, this will pass. And it does, you know, when you, this notion of time passing is very, very clear when you've got something like quitting, because each and every day brings a different type of reward, you know, like a clearer morning, a better night's sleep, more clarity, you know, a moment that you wouldn't otherwise have had if you were sort of face down in a vat of Pinot. So it's a kind of, you know, it's those little things where you can kind of, it actually is passing. It is transient, and there are little markers along the way where I can see that happening and feel that happening. So obviously it does help when there's sort of progress being made like that, but it's never going to be perfect, I think. And that is, I suppose, why we call it the messy middle.
Yeah. Definitely. The other thing as well in the mess, which is huge, is the people around you are also going to have the ripple effect of mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes the messy moment in change, we might be okay, actually. We kind of get the bit that, oh, I'm uncomfortable, I'm doing this, but it's fine. But there might be people around you that are not comfortable, or they're trying to drag you back in as well. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, the messy bit, we kind of sometimes put all on ourselves, but it's not to be underestimated that there is a group. The group mm-hmm. thing around us is huge. And I think certainly from alcohol, well, it obviously kind of depends on how you drink, why you drink, but that can be a huge factor. I interviewed Brandon Block on my podcast about his sort of journey, his door closing, which was a very forced door of hitting rock bottom and like, where do I go from here? But one of his challenges was, but the people around me are always going to buy me a drink. They're always going to say, hey, do this, do that. So how do I navigate this? Do I have to have a whole new set of people, or am I okay with it, but I'm going to have to take ownership? So yeah, messiness can be not just you. Observe what's going on around you as well.
Well, it can be a huge support at this sort of messy time of life. If it is, you know, indeed drinking that you're trying to give up, to find yourself that community of people who are all navigating that same thing together. I mean, and I know you curate communities of people who are sort of transitioning through different stages of life, and, you know, particularly post-redundancy after your first book, it was this notion of, you know, it's actually a hotbed of ideas when you bring people together in that space, because everyone's firing off all the possibilities of what if, and then can support each other in trying to achieve it. And of course, then in the drinking space, what you've got is all people kind of going, oh, this is quite hard, this is. or it's Friday, has anyone got a plan what to do apart from, you know, it begins to bring such a sort of a supportive, I'm not on my own. Yeah, I'm not on my own. I don't have to. We're not supposed to, you know, walk this world on our own. So that can be hugely helpful in the messy bit. And then your next stage is playfulness. And I said at the beginning of this, you know, I'm a massive advocate of trying to bring some kind of levity or lightness into what can feel like really dark moments. And, you know, I'm sort of really always at pains to point out that I don't have a 30-day quitting program. I have a 30-day experiment. You know, see what happens. What's the worst that could happen? Try this. See how you feel. You know, it's like literally just try and take the burden and the really sort of heavy weight out of stuff. And that I love the term playfulness that you use, because that to me is like, yeah, I get that.
It's really important. And I think it really helps you to move out of the mess quite nicely, because there's still no pressure to have all the answers, which again, that's sometimes why any form of change gets stuck, because there's a pressure to have an exact answer, and that's so rare. So the play part is about play with ideas. It's not about, oh, let's have loads of fun on this, because, I mean, you could be going through an awful time.
Sure.
But it's about play with ideas, open up, is exactly what you said, Anna, that experimentation, the curiosity of what if. Just sit with the question, what if this could be different? What if I can find a group of people who are all doing this? Mm-hmm. What if I can listen to Anna's podcast and get ideas? It's you're easing your sort of messy state into a state of possibility, but again, really nice and slowly in your way. You're still kind of owning it.
And you know, to tie back to something that you said earlier, what if I don't actually want the jobs that are on offer? What if I didn't actually like the last job, but, you know, I was in it and it was comfortable, and I, you know, what if I should have chosen to have, you know, to have left 10 years ago? And in the case of drinking, it can be, what if this happens to be the start of something amazing? What if this happens to be the best decision I've ever made and my best years are still ahead of me? You know, what if it solidifies my friendships? What if it helps me lose 10 pounds? What if it this and this, you know? So it's kind of like, it's the what-ifing stage, isn't it?
That's it.
It's the what-ifing in a positive way. It's a good time to ban the negative thoughts, this stage of playfulness, isn't it? It's about having a real brainstorm of positive positive angles and positive things that you could be doing. It's a really good time, actually, without sort of going off on too much of a tangent, to really sort of hunker down and think again about what your sort of values are, you know, and if you were to sort of, because we can become adrift from those as well, you know, if you have found yourself in a job that you're not that wedded to, or you're drinking in a way that you don't feel very comfortable, you know, I don't really like who I've become, it's a good time to kind of go, well, what do I like? How would I fill my day? Who would I want to hang out with? Who would I like to work with? All that sort of stuff. And that's expansive. That's not limiting.
And again, it's just, you don't have to have an answer. I think we've sort of maybe been pre-programmed from an early age, maybe at school, that we have to have really specific good answers, and there's a right and wrong. We either get a red pen or we get a black pen. Mm. And I do think that's true. Really deeply, deeply ingrained, that we always think we've got to have a right answer. I mean, I work with people who are trying to change, and the biggest thing that stops them from going right through is that kind of sitting on the space of, but I don't have exactly what it is right now. And we get obsessed in very strange things like, what should I put my headline for LinkedIn? Because if I announce this and that and this and that,
I've been there. Yeah.
Yes. Nobody cares, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a good thing to think about.
Yeah.
But nobody really cares if you change it 17 times. What matters is what it means to you. And I think that's an interesting one, if you're sort of knowing that you want to give up alcohol or change your relationship with alcohol. It's that playfulness that might help you, give you several different ideas about it. Oh, maybe I don't need to announce it to the next Friday night dinner party.
Absolutely.
Ta-da, I am this. No, maybe you don't need to. Yeah. You might just want to play with, what if I just drive and I actually just don't drink because of that tonight?
Yeah.
I
agree. And I always sort of tend to say to people, you know, just try life. Or an evening, or a weekend, or a rugby match, or whatever it might be, without alcohol as an experiment. It's not a verdict. It's not a forever bloody decision. If you don't like it, have a drink. Do you know what I mean? And I don't mean to say, I'm not encouraging people to sort of, you know, throw the towel in and have a drink, but literally, what's the worst that can happen? You know, if you experiment with not drinking and you don't feel any benefits to it, and you're okay, you're happy, you're at peace with your drinking, then drink. But it's, you know, it's about saying, well, but something's compelling you to try life without it. So that's got to be worth giving it a go, because it's you that's telling you to try the, you know, life without it, or people around you are worried about you. You know, just see what it's like. But again, it can take, I used to move jobs. I used to sort of really labour over the heaviness of, is this going to be the right job? Is this my forever job? We do it when we buy homes. Is this my forever house? Is this my forever house? It's like, I don't know. But if it feels right, buy it, do it, take it. If you don't like it, change it. It's, you know, it can be a bit weary to keep doing all that sort of stuff, but nobody's telling you that this is a forever anything. And, you know, everything you do, every next step you take kind of opens up more doors. So all good, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm interested in the stage of try.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
Well, we've almost started kind of going into that. That's a very deliberate thing, because naturally when you start playing with things, it creates a different energy that shifts you out of messiness. And ideas will stick with you and some will grab with you more than others. And I didn't really want to kind of go from play to just, okay, now we start and we're all good. Because what I realized was we all have very weird relationships with trying, which is why the kind of step is around joy of trying. I have a different relationship with trying. And it's exactly what you just said. It's understanding that just because we're going to make a move doesn't mean it's forever. When we make a move, you go in knowing that you're probably going to fail in some way on your terms, because failure is a label that we get to own. Like there's no standards. This is a book of fails. You're telling yourself if you fail or not, but you probably will. You'll get setbacks. You'll get all of that stuff because you're trying. And that's the only way that you'll know you're trying, if all of this stuff comes at you. If you don't experience any of that stuff, you're probably not trying, or you're just having like the best luck ever in the world. So joy of trying is this kind of concept of having a different relationship in that moment of getting on with making some moves, but not attaching so much to it that it feels like, oh, this is going to be a complete fit, because again, we get stuck again. So yeah, that's sort of the concept. It sits underneath the notion of, I believe the only thing that we can give ourselves is the gift of trying. Like all we can do is give ourselves the best chance possible of getting something we want. And if we sit on that, you know, have I even tried? It gives us an answer to what to do next.
And I think it's, I think it's Henry Ford. I was going to say, no, it is. I'm doubting myself now. I think it's Henry Ford who...
You do love your Henrys, don't you?
I do love my Henrys and I love my quotes. quotes by Henrys make my day. It's Henry Ford. And he said, the only moment you fail is when you stop trying.
Yeah. Oh, did he? I never knew that. Maybe I've subliminally taken that in.
I might have given that a slight Anna Donaghy spin, but it's the only time you fail is when you stop trying. So as you can imagine, I'm sitting on calls sometimes or in meetings with people who are saying, I didn't intend to have a drink last night. I had a drink. I'm such a fuck up. I failed. And I'm like, failed? Hang on a goddamn minute. We don't talk about failure, because here you are talking to me, which means you're still trying, right? And you intend to carry on trying. Yes, I intend to carry on trying. Good. Then you're not failing. So what can we learn from what happened last night? And we talk about the data points, which are, you know, it's more than semantics. It's a very important way of reframing moments that you think are failures into saying, what learning can I derive from this? So, you know, on a bigger level, if you were to sort of say, I'm going to take this job because I actually have a kind of financial imperative to bring some money in, and you go off and you take a sort of an interim job, but it's not everything you want it to be. Oh, you might think that's going to look like a blip on my CV. No. It's a data point for you. You tried on a new job. You didn't like it. What was it about that job? What was it about the nature of it, or the working hours, or the people you were working with? Why? Don't write it off and not derive anything from it. And but certainly don't just sit there in a vacuum of not trying, because you don't think you're going to get anything out of it or anything like that. So,
yeah, it's an interesting one from your client's point of view, because yeah, they might, that might be the moment where they just go back to square one and just start drinking again. Look, I tried, I failed, it's over. I'm just going to be an alcoholic forever, or whatever you want to term the story. That's where you go back into pause.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said at the beginning, Anna, it's not like a 5-step we're done. It's just a framework to think. But when you start in the try space, especially in any change, we can slip into catastrophize. We can, you know, we can start telling, oh, this is failing, this is awful.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't done the work on, oh, no, I just need to stop, take that question again of what do I need right now? It might be, oh, I just need some time out, step out a minute. And then I step back in again and keep going.
Yeah.
And so that's why the pause is, we spend so much time in it, because it can really help you from undoing. It can just give you a moment to kind of step out and then step back in and keep moving forward. So yeah, such a good point of moments that we think, oh, we're just back to square one.
Yeah, well, this is not a quote by a guy called Henry. I'm going to claim this one all for myself, which is this idea that if you're setting your objective as trying, or in my case, I would often say to clients, you know, set your objective to be one of learning, then it's actually impossible to fail. You can't fail against an objective of learning. You can have a setback and go, okay, I might as well, I can learn from it. Well, then it's clearly not a failure. So if you do end up going one step forward and two steps back, I would always say, well, you can never be back at square one, because you've got learnings that you can't take away again. You might feel like you're back in a space where drinking's becoming a bit too habitual again, and you might feel you should be further down the line. But where you are is where you are. You've learned so much. Now's the time to pull it out and carry on, you know, keep trying. And I think that's a fundamental objective when you're sort of faced with this notion of going through change, where one of the biggest fears is always going to be a failure. I'm so scared of failing, I'm not going to try at all. It's completely missing the point. The point as I kind of define it, which is, you know, use it to learn, forced learning in a way, you know, use it to learn about yourself. And then there can never be any failure attached to that, ever.
Mm. Yeah, nice concept to sit with, isn't it? That's kind of reassuring. Yeah, love that. Quoted by Henry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, so when you are sitting there now sort of reflecting on your book and thinking to yourself, if I had to condense this down into sort of words of encouragement for someone sitting on the cusp of change and feeling a bit jittery about it, or some, you know, perish a thought, but you know, it's probably likely that people listen to this who have got moments of change coming up in their lives, they're fearing, you know, fearing the strength with which they can deal with it. It's terribly hard to ask you to distill this down, Eleanor, but what would your little sort of pithy words of wisdom be?
Yeah. Oh yeah, this is a good one.
Buy my book.
Yeah, exactly. Buy the book. It's got all the answers. It's like the elevator pitch, isn't it, that me and you probably worked on a lot in corporate days.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, and obviously the fifth step is the restart and owning start. And so in a way, the elevator pitch is that fifth step of ownership. And it's if you are sort of navigating any kind of change. And also, I kind of like that, Henry Cloud, that, you know, the notion of positive change, because equally, promotions are change, marriage is change, becoming a parent is change. You know, positive things in life are change. We still have to go through these five steps, I believe, to make the most of it. Otherwise, we get a bit lost in it. So it's getting to that end point of restart and own it with intent. So we're really intentional about it. So if we pause and understand when we need time out, that's not failure, as you said. It's just we need to step out and think. Then we're allowed to get messy at any time in life, and it's fine to be uncomfortable. It might be giving you lessons, which again, it's what you just said there beautifully. Then the play bit, we can activate at any moment to start to energize us or to give us other answers, and never underestimate the moment of, like what you said, just a little experiment or just a curiosity. It shifts your energy. And that'll help you try, and it'll help you get back into the space of, you know, that bit, the end goal, which is I'm going to own this and step into it, whatever that kind of looks like. So I think that's where the steps coming to life, whatever change, good, bad, hard, minor, micro, it's the ownership. I'm owning this. I feel like I have agency. Even when it goes wrong, I still got, it's mine. It's my wrongness, which I'm loving. So it's kind of that. That was a very long elevator. It was maybe like the big building in Abu Dhabi or Dubai, wherever the big massive building is. I'm very bad at that, but I think that was perhaps a long elevator pitch.
No, that's cool. Because as I was listening, I think I saw a Vulcan mind meld going on, because I wrote down two words, which is intentional reinvention. You know, it's a But that was running. Yeah, exactly. I think that sort of, for me, that sums up what you're saying. It's choosing. It's choosing what comes next, and realizing that you know, standing in that space and realizing that you do have that choice. I'm very conscious of the time, as I knew we would. We filled quite a long time. But I love it. I love how you've helped reframe the change, not as something to fear or even feel that you need to utterly control, because that's the other thing, isn't it? We have to try and we feel sort of safe and secure when we're in control, and sometimes we're just not. But more as a sort of a process to move with. So yeah, in a way that, you know, I suppose you know, the pause, if this is all about intentional reinvention, then the pause, the mess, the play, they're not kind of like detours, they're the work. But they're how we work out what comes next, and not just in a purely logical way, but in a totally expansive, open up the world of possibilities kind of way. So thank you for that. Thank you very much. And I guess what I would do is I would go to sort of leave listeners with this sort of thought that if they're sort of rushing around trying to figure it all out, or thinking that they need to have it all figured out, my sort of question would be, if, you know, to maybe consider, if you close the door on alcohol this week, what could you be making space for? You know, and just sit with that and just think about that, because that's where the real release after the resistance comes in, not enforcing the next step, but sort of just softening and just allowing that space to consider. Where can people find you, Eleanor?
Very tempted to say down the pub.
You can say down the pub. I might edit it. I will edit it out. All right. Eleanor can be found in her local every night of the week.
I will be in the pub. No. Sorry, Phoebe. That's our edit. I'm joking. Sorry.
She's the one on the bar stool with her name on it. Drinking out of a pint glass with her name on it.
Yeah. Do you know what the funniest thing about that is, though? Because I was going, down the pub, like as a funny joke, which isn't funny at all. but I drive so much. Like I have a very nice car. I've always had a very nice car for a very specific reason, because it means that I don't get really drunk. Like, I used to work for a beer company, and I used to get nice corporate cars because it meant. So that's the funny thing, that you might see me down the pub, but I still won't be drinking because my nice car's outside. Anyway, I'll be on LinkedIn.
Okay, it'll be on
which
LinkedIn.
Which isn't as fun as the pub, but yeah, I hang out on LinkedIn or anotherdoor.co.uk.
And your book, Another Door Opens, is on Amazon?
Yes. Yeah, not in bookshops yet quite, but I'm trying.
Getting there. But, a matter of time, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for sharing your time.
Thanks, Anna.
No worries. You take care. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about The Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS, coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.